Do you know people who seem especially lucky or unlucky? Well, what about you? Do you feel lucky? What are your chances of rolling the right number, drawing the best cards, making the best choices? Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about chance, probability, and luck, and how much of what happens to us is or is not within our control. I'm joined now by Richard Wiseman, a professor of psychology at the University of Hertfordshire in England. He's the author of The Luck Factor, Changing Your Luck, Changing Your Life, The Four Essential Principles, published by Miramax Books, and by Jeffrey Rosenthal, a professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto. He's the author of two textbooks about probability theory and a book for general audiences called Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities. It's published by Joseph Henry Press. And I'm very pleased to welcome the two of you to Please Explain. And before we begin, a reminder to our listeners that they're invited to join in on the discussion by giving us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm throwing this out to you, Richard, first, I guess, but it applies to both of you. I'm sure both of you have thought a great deal about how people can make the best of life, though it seems filled with randomness and chance. But you have come at these ideas from very different perspectives, so maybe we should start by having each of you provide some definitions so we know where you're starting from. Richard, how do you find luck in your work? How is it different from chance?
I think it's a very important distinction for me. So I would use the word chance to talk about events over which we really have no control at all. So whether you win or lose at the roulette table, some sorts of accidents, some sorts of illnesses, where they're really nothing to do with your control. It doesn't matter whether you have a positive attitude or a negative attitude. It doesn't influence it at all. Where for me, luck, it feels like chance. But I think that's a kind of illusion. The reality is that you can influence those sorts of events. So I kind of draw a line between chance and luck, and I guess it's a psychological line. Chance you can't influence, luck you can, even though you may not realize it.
Well, I want to return to that in a moment because that was a rather open-ended answer. But Jeffrey, from a mathematician's point of view, can you help us understand some of the terms that are related to our ideas of luck? For example, randomness. What does random mean?
Right. Well, it is actually quite hard to define these things precisely, and I think that one does have to be very careful with what one means. So, for example, the way I would think about it coming from a mathematical probability point of view is that random is anything that we don't know what's going to happen next. So whether it's whether the bus is going to be late or the airplane's going to crash or anything like that, we don't know what's going to happen. But we can try to assess the probabilities. We can think, okay, usually the airplane isn't going to crash, and you know my chance of winning the lottery is very low, but the bus being late, well, that happens every Friday or something like that. So we can get a sense of things. And to me, understanding the probabilities out there is how we can best cope with the world.
Now, Richard, you said that we have some kind of a control over luck. How do we do that? We think of ourselves as having been born lucky, or if we're born into good circumstances, or unlucky to have been born into terrible circumstances. But we had no control over that, did we? Or is that really random because we're what we are is only partly determined by the genetic mixtures of our fathers and mothers?
Well, it's certainly true that in terms of your genetics or the situation you're born into, you don't have control over that. So I would see that as essentially a chance event. However, how you respond to that situation, and we all know people who are born into, you know, not particularly affluent homes or particularly positive childhood scenarios and yet have thrived and have done very well, how you respond to that scenario, I think, is a lot to do with luck, in the sense that it's a way of looking at the world. You can look for opportunities, or you can, you know, look at this wonderful upbringing that you've had and actually see the worst of it and move downhill from that particular position and therefore consider yourself unlucky. So I would say the genetics, the situation you're born into, probably it's chance, but how you respond to it, whether you make the most of it, is to do with whether you will experience good or bad luck. And it's that concept that fascinates me as a psychologist.
And what are the one of the experiments that you did in your research involved a puzzle that couldn't be solved. You found that people who felt lucky tried harder.
Well, that's one of the, perhaps not particularly surprising, but key attributes of a lucky life. And in our work, we studied the psychological differences between people who consider themselves exceptionally lucky and unlucky. And you could present them with the same scenario as we did with the puzzle experiment and see two very different worlds emerge. So in that particular study, we had a puzzle which was impossible to solve. And we said, we'd like you to have a go at this, but we didn't tell them that there was no solution. And you'd see the unlucky people giving up pretty early on and saying, well, I'm sure there's nothing to be done here, and the lucky people persevering. Even when you gave them a puzzle where there was a solution, the unlucky people would say, you know, I bet you give me one of these ones where there's nothing to be found here. I can't find the answer. And they would give up early on again. So you can see that in life, that ability to persevere in the face of failure, which is linked to concepts of resilience, all these kind of core psychological skills are embedded within the lucky person, even though they may not realize it.
Jeffrey, I've read that you were born on Friday the 13th. Has that ever given you pause?
Right, I was born on Friday the 13th, but I've actually had quite a fortunate life and quite good circumstances, so I always use that as an example of proving that these superstitions that people have and beliefs that there's some supernatural powers that control us based on whether it's a lucky rabbit's foot or Friday the 13th, there's really nothing to them, and the fact that I was born on Friday the 13th, but I've always been quite fortunate, shows that that's just not the case.
Well, the idea of luck is connected to deeply held human beliefs about the way the world works and whether or not we can influence events or whether fate determines things. In the work that you've done, what's your sense of how many of us actually believe in luck in one form or another?
In my research, around about 12% of people consider themselves exceptionally lucky and about 9% exceptionally unlucky. And that's pretty consistent in different countries around the world. In terms of believing in luck, you have to be very careful about how you phrase the question. Certainly around about two-thirds of the population are superstitious and would say, yes, you know, I carry a lucky rabbit's foot or I cross my fingers or whatever. But in terms of saying, do you believe in luck and fate and destiny, again, you have to explain those concepts a bit. But you come in at figures around about two-thirds of the population that say, yes, you know, I believe my fate is determined or, you know, my luck takes me on my course to my destiny. So even though we're living in a world with a huge amount of technology around us, where we probably understand more about probability and maths than we've ever done in our past, we still are magical thinkers, and that really should give us pause for thought and question, you know, whether that is the best way forward and where that sometimes leads societies. But yes, the truth of the matter is that a lot of people are out there believing that they are destined to live a certain life and that luck takes them on that path.
One of my producers, who's asked to be nameless, cannot help herself when she sees a penny. She has to pick it up, even though she thinks of herself as a rational person. She believes the penny will have some influence on the outcome of future events in her life.
Well, that's a curious one, because some of the research we've found is that lucky people actually do hold superstitious ideas, but what they tend to do is focus on the positive superstitions, the notion that if you do this, good things will happen. If you cross your fingers or touch wood, then good things will happen. And of course, what that does is make them more optimistic about the future. And of course, they then go forward and create that good luck. The unlucky people are equally superstitious, but in the opposite direction. They become terribly concerned if they walk under a ladder or smash a mirror. And of course, that feeds on the notion that they're going to be unlucky people. And no matter what they do, they're always going to be cursed with this ill fortune. And it just makes them even more anxious. And again, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we have to be a little bit careful as we unpack the superstition idea. And so if, you know, picking up a penny makes your producer friend feel better, well, actually, it may not be a bad thing to do, even though essentially it's an irrational thing.
My guests are Richard Wiseman, professor of psychology at the University of Hertfordshire, England, and Jeffrey Rosenthal, a professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto. And this is Please Explain on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Jeffrey, how does luck play a role in what you do as a mathematician?
Right. Well, I mean, I would also distinguish, as Richard was saying, between the sort of luck that, I mean, what I wouldn't really even call luck, but he's calling luck that someone who has, you know, self-confidence and persistence and is optimistic and therefore is able to get things done and able to succeed more. I mean, I wouldn't even use the word luck. I would just say that's someone who, because of their own skill and hard work, is going to succeed. And that's distinct, as Richard was saying, from the sort of superstitious things that say, well, I have some magical control over whether it's the weather or the lottery or the casino, and people will believe a certain person is lucky. So from a mathematical point of view, I would say that, you know, if there's something that really is out of your control, like at a casino, let's say, we can compute exactly the odds of you're going to win this game or win that game. We know that over the long run, you're much more likely to lose than to win, and we can quantify that. And if someone says, oh, wait, but I had a rabbit's foot in my pocket, or oh, wait, but I'm a lucky person, or oh, wait, but I've always been unlucky, then I'm not interested in that, because from the mathematical point of view, that doesn't actually change anything. But nonetheless, as Richard said, people do have a lot of beliefs about that. And to my mind, it's very important to distinguish between that and understand mathematically how we can understand the world around us using probability as opposed to believing in the superstition.
Well, as a mathematician, how do you respond to the commonly held beliefs all over the world in lucky numbers, although they're different in different parts of the world?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of things people believe in, from lucky numbers to rabbit's feet to, you know, you mentioned the ladders and you mentioned picking up the pennies, and it's almost hard to keep track of all the different things that people will believe. And one thing that I find interesting, because, you know, I'm quite confident as a scientist and a mathematician that really those things do not influence events that are out of our control. One thing, as Richard was saying, is that they could, of course, psychologically influence the person who believes them. And if you believe that the rabbit's foot makes you lucky, maybe you'll be more confident and maybe you'll end up succeeding. But also, I think there's what we sometimes call a biased observation, in that if people believe something strongly enough, then they're going to just notice evidence which tends to support it. And they'll say, remember the time I had that rabbit's foot and I, you know, won money or I got a job, so that proved that the rabbit's foot was lucky. And they won't remember the time they had the rabbit's foot, but they had bad luck and they didn't get the job and they lost money. So if people really want to believe things, it's very difficult to convince them otherwise.
So lucky charms or rituals are self-reinforcing.
They can be, right. Either both because from a psychological point of view, it makes you more confident and therefore you do end up succeeding, or because you only notice the times that it helped you. And yeah, people believe a lot of things. And as you say, they're not always the same in different countries, but they believe them very strongly.
Our phone number here is 212-433-9692. Our first caller is Dan from Westfield, New Jersey. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay.
Good.
I'm feeling lucky today.
Yes, I've always found myself very lucky, and I have no idea why. I'm not superstitious, but I've won contests and hotel stays and VCRs and movies and books and all kinds of things, and it just seems to be in my nature, and I'm not sure exactly why.
You mean when there's a raffle, you're the guy who wins?
Lots of times, yes.
I'm really upset with you, you know, because I never win those things. Dan, I'm going to hang up on you. I'm so upset with you. No. What about that? There are some people who tend to win when there are raffles, and they're the ones who always seem to walk into the situation at the right moment. Richard?
Well, Dan sounds very typical of most of the participants in our study. We studied 1,000 people across the world who considered themselves exceptionally lucky and unlucky. And what was fascinating is their luck didn't seem to just concentrate in one area, but it was a generalized thing that they were kind of lucky in love and lucky when it came to raffles and always found a parking space when they needed one and so on. Now, with something like winning raffles, where you should be up against a chance system, it could be that Dan is just out on one extreme of the bell curve because someone has to be there, and it could be him. It could be that he's entering more of these things because he has a reputation for being lucky, or perhaps not remembering the times is lost. Or it just could be one of those, you know, slightly strange things that we don't kind of fully understand. So there's all sorts of explanations. What I do find interesting is that winning some of those sorts of competitions kicks off a mindset that then starts to spread to other areas of your life, and particularly in terms of how other people perceive you. If you're perceived as a lucky person, people want to be around you. If you're perceived as unlucky, they get out of there pretty quickly. And you can see that even in very young children, that there's been experiments carried out where they sort of essentially convince children that one member of the class is lucky or unlucky, and it has those effects even at a very young age in terms of attraction or rejection. So that's where our superstitious thinking really comes into play. So there could be all sorts of factors going on, but Dan sounds you know, very typical of the sorts of people that we studied for 10 years.
You want to add anything, Jeffrey?
Yeah, so it is interesting when people, as Dan is saying, say they've won a lot of things, and certainly part of it could be that he's entered lots of contests, and part of it could be that he just did get lucky because, you know, somebody's going to win each time and somebody might win more than their share. But the way, as a mathematician, that I would sort of try to sort out the issues is to say, suppose we went to a raffle with Dan tonight, what's the chance that Dan's going to win tonight? And I would argue that since I don't believe in any superstitious power, that Dan would have just the same chance as everybody else of winning the next draw tonight, even if in the past he's won a lot because either he's entered a lot of times or he's just happened to be fortunate in the past. So that's where I would draw the distinction, that there's no sort of magical power that says Dan or anyone else is a lucky person and therefore they have to win next time.
How many times do you have to flip a coin before you get a 50-50 split on heads and tails? Don't you have to do it an awful lot of times?
Well, the more you do it, the closer you will get to 50-50, and that's what we call the law of large numbers. And it's the same principle that says if you're polling people in an election, then the more people you ask, the closer you'll get to the true fraction who support the candidate. Or if you go to the casino, if you play just a few times, you might get lucky and win. But if you play a lot of times and over the long run, the casino's house edge is going to work against you. And it's the same principle. So with a coin, for example, say you flip a coin 1,000 times, well, you probably won't get exactly 500 heads, but you'll probably be within about maybe 3% plus or minus of the 50%. And it's the same with polls. If you poll 1,000 people, you won't get the exact fraction that support a candidate, but you'll be within about plus or minus 3%. So the more times you flip a coin or ask a question or do an experiment or enter raffles for that matter, the closer you'll get to winning your true fraction.
My guests are Jeffrey Rosenthal, a professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto, author of two textbooks about probability theory and a book for general audiences from Joseph Henry Press called Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities. Also with us is Richard Wiseman, professor of psychology at the University of Hertfordshire, England. He's written The Luck Factor, Changing Your Luck, Changing Your Life, The Four Essential Principles. That's published by Miramax Books. Our number here, 212-433-9692. We will be back with more of your calls after this. And we're back with Jeffrey Rosenthal, professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto, and Richard Wiseman, a professor of psychology at the University of Hertfordshire in England. Richard, what got you even considering the concept of luck in your research?
I think it was a few things. I mean, part of it was personal, though when I look back on my own life, I realized that how the smallest of events had a huge impact on me. So when I was a kid, I was kind of into chess and went to the local library to find a chess book, was given the wrong directions, ended up in the magic section, opened a book on magic, got hooked on that, and ended up becoming a professional magician for a few years before I became a psychologist. So that's had a huge impact, and that was just a chance event. And later on, when I was working as a psychologist, I was interviewing people about the key moments in their lives, you know, how they ended up in certain careers with certain partners and so on. And this notion of chance meetings, or things could have been so different had this tiny event not worked out in this particular way, just kept on coming up again and again. And people would describe themselves as lucky or unlucky. And all those years ago, scientists had really dismissed the concept. And so I thought it was time to kind of put the record straight and try and understand the psychology of what was going on here.
Can you tell us about some of the experiments you've conducted and what they reveal? First, counting newspaper photographs.
Well, the work was a 10-year research project where we monitored the lives of about 1,000 exceptionally lucky and unlucky people. So we asked them to come into the lab, take part in studies, keep diaries, and so on. And in one of the studies, probably the best known one, we asked people to flick through a newspaper and just count the number of pictures in there, which is a fairly tedious thing to do, but you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And what we didn't tell them is we placed two rather large opportunities inside the newspaper. Each one took up half a page. One of them said in very large font, stop counting, there are 52 photographs in here. The other one said win £100 by telling the experiment you'd seen this. And our unlucky people were so focused and so worried and so anxious, they would just see the photographs they were trying to count, and they'd just go straight past these opportunities. The unlucky people tend to be more laid back, more playful. They're seeing the bigger picture. They'd spot them straight away and ask, you know, whether they got their money. So that really got us thinking about not only this issue of optimism and luck, but also the more cognitive side of things, of how our attention, if we're just very, very focused on a tiny thing, often you can miss the most obvious opportunity in front of you, how that can then feed to become into a lucky life. And then the latter part of the research was getting people to change their way of thinking, change their way of behaving, and we could see experimentally that you could increase people's luck.
Now, Jeffrey, what Richard is talking about has a lot to do, is totally about psychology. How does this apply to someone who deals with statistics? Do you think about psychology at all?
Sure. I mean, it comes up quite a bit because of how people perceive things. So, for example, if you ask people what the probabilities are for things to happen, then we're always trying to assess that based on limited information. And really, you could say that's what statistics is all about, is trying to take whatever information we do have, whether it's the results of a medical experiment or the results of historical data from the stock market or anything else, and saying, based on this limited information, what can we predict, or what's the probability that such and such will happen, on average, what's going to happen next, and so on. So a lot of what we do is to do with estimating probabilities, and some of it is the mathematical side of saying, well, once we assume this, then we can compute that. And some of it is not as precise as that, and some of it is definitely psychological and trying to say, well, what can we infer based on what we know, and so on. So there's always an interplay in figuring out, you know, what's the correct way to approach the statistics and what are the accurate conclusions that we can draw.
Let's take some calls. Richard from Jamaica Hills, you're on the air.
Hi. Speaking about being able to change your luck, I saw a program on the Science Channel a couple of weeks ago about some experiments which were actually conducted in Canada, but I'm not sure quite where, in which an individual was sitting next to a computer which was supposed to be generating ones and zeros, and was asked to concentrate on generating either a one or a zero, and some individuals were statistically, over and over again, able to alter the probability of a one or a zero coming up. And I'm wondering if any of you have had experience with that.
Well, I mean, I could try to respond and say that, you know, again, it would depend on the details, of course, of how the experiment was set up and how it was run and how the ones and zeros were actually being generated, whether there was a way to guess it. But, I mean, I would still maintain, even at the risk of being a party pooper, that, you know, if it really is true that the ones and zeros are coming up in some random fashion that's not predictable, then, you know, there's just nothing at all that we understand about science and so on that would say that the way a human thinks could actually cause some changes in the way the computer is running. And indeed, if it really were possible to consistently scientifically prove that the way somebody thinks could alter the reality of a computer next to them, that would just be incredible. It would just completely change the way we understand science. It would change all of technology, all of the way we think about all those things. And I just think that usually when you look at the details, those things are not actually able to be reproduced, and they don't actually prove that people have these magical powers. So.
I would support Jeffrey on that. I mean, some of my work is in what's called parapsychology, which is precisely this idea of that somehow our minds influence the physical world. And those sorts of experiments, it's certainly true that some of them have yielded positive results. But when you look at all of them put together, there's a lot of debate about whether the effect is genuine, and most scientists think that it is probably not. But there's an important lesson in there, because very early on in our work, we looked at the lottery numbers the lucky and unlucky people were choosing. And our lucky people were far more confident of winning the national lottery than the unlucky ones. But in fact, because they were up against a completely chance system, there was no difference in the success or failure of the two groups once you controlled for the number of tickets that were being bought. So one of the things we do say is that, you know, if you want to change your luck, we're talking about luck in life, meeting certain partners, being in certain careers, and so on. We're not advising anyone to go to a casino thinking they're terribly lucky, because there you're up against what we're referring to as chance, and you're probably going to lose your money. So I think there's a very important point being made here.
Audrey from Westchester, you're on the air.
Yes, actually, some of the observations I was going to make already have been made, but I find that optimism really takes you a long way. When my husband and I go driving into New York and try to find a free parking spot, I usually find it because he goes down there, and already all the way from Westchester, he decides he can't find it. And actually, it reminds me of a study that was done where people who mimicked being happy actually felt better.
Richard?
Absolutely. I mean, the parking space example comes up cross-culturally. It's quite bizarre that people would say...
Oh, he totally drives past it and decides there's no parking.
Oh, that, Yes, I was in New York a couple of weeks ago. I noticed that, so I'm surprised that anyone could find a space anywhere.
But Audrey, that's why he needs you.
Ride with me.
He's lucky he found you.
I know. He keeps on telling me that.
Well, that's good. That's good. He recognizes that. So as you say, you know, if you don't expect to seize opportunities, you drive straight past them. And so I think that is absolutely key. In terms of the happiness study, again, you're absolutely right. It's what psychologists refer to as facial feedback, that when we experience happiness, we smile, but there's also a feedback system in the other direction. So if you force your face into a smile, then yes, indeed, you feel happier. If you sit up straight, for example, then you'll persevere more with a problem that's in front of you. So all this kind of feedback mechanism from the body and the face is very, very important. And I think we're only now starting to understand that the power of optimism, that hoping that the future will be bright, for the most part, is good for us. There are some circumstances where that can be a false hope, and you can be overly optimistic. You know, you don't want to cross the street, you know, not looking in both directions because you're so convinced that you're not going to get hit by traffic. So there are certain circumstances where it's not so good, but overall, certainly, yes, optimism is good for you.
We're talking about luck on today's Please Explain with Richard Wiseman, a professor of psychology, and Jeffrey Rosenthal, a professor of statistics. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Michael from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if your guests are, I'm sure you're familiar with the principle, Jung's principle of synchronicity, that are there's a non-causal relationship between events, objective events, that actually are meaningful to human beings. The classic story of Jung doing dream work with one of his clients, and in the dream he's recollecting seeing a particular type of moth, and that, in fact, as he's recollecting that very same objective physical moth floated in and landed on the table next to Jung as he was doing this psychoanalysis with his patient. And, you know, he put that into a principle of synchronicity, and I'm wondering if you guys are familiar with that principle and how you explain it from the point of view of mathematical probability.
Right, if I can try to answer that. So yeah, I certainly am familiar with the principle of synchronicity, and it's interesting because it's something that, you know, appeals to a lot of people because they'll remember a time that they have a story, something like the one you described with Jung, where, you know, I was just thinking about so-and-so and then he phoned me on the phone and so on. And it can be hard to explain those things if you don't stop and think about it. But when you stop and think about it more, you'll realize that mostly they can be explained either by some sort of hidden cause. That is, maybe the reason I was thinking about that guy is because he told me he was going to call me today, or, you know, something like that. Or if not, then often it's because we just sort of, again, remember the things that happen that way. And so we think it happens a lot, whereas, of course, by chance it's going to happen some. I remember the Richard Feynman, the physicist, he wrote an autobiography, and he talks about a time back when he was a graduate student, and he just suddenly got a feeling that his grandmother had died. And just then the phone rang, and the phone was for somebody else, and his grandmother was fine. So it's a silly little story, but he uses it as a point to say that all the time there's opportunities where if something happened, it would have looked like, yeah, it was synchronicity or it was some special power, and almost all the time it doesn't happen, and then we don't really think about it anymore. So the one time that the moth we're thinking about does come in, or the guy we're thinking about does call us, we think, aha, that proves something. Actually, that could just be happening just by randomness.
We go now to Amy from, where are you from? Oh, Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Montvale, New Jersey. Hi, how are you? My question is more about probability. My dad is 80 years old now. When I was growing up, he would buy a lottery ticket every week. And one day he told me that his brother, who was a physicist, told him that, my dad would buy more and more tickets trying to win. And his brother said, no, Ray, you don't buy more tickets. You have the exact same chance of winning no matter how many tickets you buy. So can you explain that to me and my dad?
Sure. Well, if I can try that again. That's actually not true. It's true that the more tickets you buy, it does increase your chance of winning, as long as you don't pick the same numbers on the same draw every time. But on the other hand, what is true is that the chance of winning the lottery jackpot is so infinitesimally small that, you know, whether you buy one ticket or you buy 10 tickets or you buy 100 tickets, your chance of winning is still extremely small. And I never buy commercial lottery tickets because I just understand so well how small the chances are. But nonetheless, it is true that if you buy two different tickets, you have twice as good a chance of winning the jackpot.
And that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? If you buy 1,000, you're increasing your possibility even more. But on the other hand, there you're probably going to lose money ultimately because the odds are still strongly against you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can buy more tickets, you'll increase your chance of winning, but you'll also have to spend more. And the average sort of fraction of your cost that you'll lose remains the same. So on average, you're going to lose money buying lottery tickets no matter how you.
Stacy from Maplewood, New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I completely agree with you that luck is self-made. But I'm curious as to what your guests might think about why certain kinds of symbols of luck become fixed in our general psyche. Like, for example, Friday the 13th is actually commemoration of the day that the French king ordered all the Templars killed and took their treasure.
I thought it was because Geoffrey was born on Friday the 13th.
Well, I think it predates me, actually. It predates me.
So I mean, most people don't know that that's where Friday the 13th came from, and yet there's no 13th row on airplanes. There's no 13th floor in hotels.
Right.
It's a pervasive underpinning of our culture, and yet no one knows why. So why some events and not others?
I think some of it is bound up in mythology. So, for example, touching wood is trying to get the pagan wood gods, which are apparently benign gods, on your side. Crossing fingers is making, obviously, the symbol of the cross. 13, whether it's lucky or unlucky, varies right across Europe. So in some countries, you know, people want to be living in house number 13. Certainly in the UK and the US, that's not the case. And in fact, your house price goes down if you're at number 13. So it is interesting, but some of these things have very, very old roots. So walking under a ladder is seen as breaking the Trinity because you have the 3 points of contact. Sorry, not 2 points of contact and the wall and the pavement. So, some of these have very, very old roots. But then, you know, other ones are very recent, you know. But certainly they are the cross-cultural ones, which go right the way around the world, tend to have religious underpinnings.
Perhaps we should have done this show next Friday, which is Friday the 13th.
That's right.
Or Friday in March, which is Friday the 13th. We have two coming up. We're going to sneak another call in here. David from Queens, you have to make it very quick.
Hi. I just wanted to say, recently I saw something that someone showed me. I don't know if your guest had heard about it. It's called The Secret, and it's about thinking about something and actually changing your luck by thinking about it. So if I think about I'm about meeting a girl today, then if a girl, you know, crosses my path, I think, oh, I thought about it. So that's why it came to me, you know. But I when I watched it, I didn't believe it. I was like, I think about a million things a day. Like, how can I think about something and it happen? I just don't think that makes any sense.
Well, it did lead to a best-selling book, didn't it? Are either of you familiar with it?
Oh, the Secret is absolutely huge. And it may have psychological underpinnings. I mean, there's a concept known as priming, which is that you notice more opportunities when you primed your mind. So it could be that if you're on the lookout for a girlfriend, you just simply notice more opportunities. Or it might not work at all. We don't know because there hasn't really been any scientific study of the idea.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Okay. Richard Wiseman is professor of psychology at University of Hertfordshire. Geoffrey Rosenthal, a professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto. Thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Pleasure.
Thank you.